Welcome to the Breakaway Podcast. Thanks for joining us in our study of the Psalms. For more information on Breakaway, visit breakawayministries.org. We hope you enjoy the talk and stick around for more at the end.
Well, next week is Holy Week, and that's the time when Christians around the globe collectively turn our attention towards the crucifixion and the death and the burial of Jesus Christ on our way towards Easter, which is a celebration of the resurrection of Jesus. And it was during the crucifixion of Jesus that he uttered one of the most famous lines in really all of human history. Like, even if you don't read your Bible, you're probably familiar with the reality that as Jesus hung suffering on the cross, that he cried out at one point, "My God, my God, why have you forsaken me?" And that brings up an important question as we think about that, and as billions of people are going to come around that and think about that in the days ahead, it brings up the question, why did he say that? Why in that moment of anguish did he cry out, my God, why have you forsaken me? That's a good question to ask. Albert Schweitzer said that that cry from Jesus indicated that Jesus died as a deluded apocalyptic, that his messianic expectations went unfulfilled, that when life got really hard, this man who had preached hope lost it all at the end. That's what he felt that this was, that that was a cry of utter defeat and of ruin at the end of his ministry. Which brings up an important question. If that's true, why do we call that day Good Friday? That's not good. That's horrible. That this man who preached redemption and hope lost all his hope at the end. Is that really what's happening here? That's a horrible thing. Why would we celebrate that? Why would we sing about that? And so we got to figure out, why did Jesus say that? But here's the thing. It's not just a theological problem we got to answer. It's a personal problem. Like, if we're going to just be selfish for a moment, we got to ask the question, going, okay, if there was no better person on the planet than Jesus, and at his greatest point of need, God abandoned him, what hope do I have when I suffer? What's going to happen to me when I go through some of the most difficult times I've been through in life? What happens when I feel like God has forsaken me? Has he done that? Where am I with him when I suffer? And I thought about in this moment just telling stories of suffering that I've been through with the back injuries I had in drama, or what our staff has been through the last few weeks where we've been, many of us, to funerals or in ICUs for different reasons. But the truth is, I don't have to go into all that. I remember my days in college. Even without some particularly dramatic external thing happening, I remember for me in college, my freshman year was one of extreme crisis of just dealing with some emotional problems in me. There wasn't some external thing that I'd say, it's because of that. There was just something wrong with me, and there were some questions I'm asking God. God, will you answer this question for me? I got this problem I don't understand. God, there's this thing about you or about the world or about myself I don't get, and I feel like you're not answering me. And some of you know what that feels like, whether you've been in some external trial and suffering or just internally. You've wept over a relationship not working out or something going on in you that you've gone, okay, I'm praying, I'm doing everything I'm supposed to do. God, where are you? Why have you forsaken me? So we got to figure out a couple things tonight, and that is, number one, why did Jesus say this? And then number two, what does it mean for me when I enter my time of suffering? When I need him most, is God going to ditch me? And then number three is, what do we do with all of this? And so, as many of you know, we've been in this semester looking at the Psalms, the songbook of the Old Testament, and this is actually not a departure from that, because Jesus' declaration on the cross, many of you know that when he cried out, my God, why have you forsaken me? He was quoting a psalm, Psalm 22. It was called the Song of the Innocent Sufferer. And it was written, most likely, by King David, written a solid 1,000 years before Jesus was born. And so we're going to look into this psalm that was written by David around 1,000 BC, and it's going to give us insight into why it was Jesus' cry of choice on the cross, and then what it means for us in our darkest days. And so we're just going to move through it together, and I think it'll all become clearer as we move through it. But when the psalm opens, it opens with that heart-wrenching cry in verse 1. My God, Why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from saving me from the words of my groaning? Oh my God, I cry by day, but you don't answer, and by night, but I find no rest. Now, it's interesting when you read that to ask the question, what is disturbing the writer? And as you look at what he's saying there, we actually don't really know what was the specific crisis the psalmist who wrote the song was going through. He doesn't give us a lot of detail of what he was going through, the original problem, but it was something pretty intense. And yet as you read this, you notice whatever he was experiencing, the physical pain, the rejection we hear about later, that was a problem. Was the physical pain a problem? Yes. Was the rejection a problem? Yes. But at the deepest root, there's something else going on here. What's really in focus here for him is not the sense of the physical pain he's going through, but his distress at a sense of God's distance. What's upsetting to the psalmist when he wrote this was what felt like a total contradiction between his theology and his experience. That he says, you're my God. Three times he calls him my God. And in doing that, he unites transcendence and immanence. You're God. You're the almighty one that rules the world. You're transcendent, but you're also intimate. You're my God. I'm connected to you. Later, he'll call him Yahweh. That was the covenant name of God. The way it worked back then, the way they understood it, the way it works now is that when you make a covenant with God, it's that, hey, I give my whole life to you. And I donate my life to you. I belong to you. I am yours. And so on the flip side, you're my God. And namely, what that means is you'll be my provider and my protector. That's how he understood it. And so he understood that's the connection I have with God. And then the psalmist hit a moment of crisis in his life. And he's like, okay, I'm calling it in. I'm filing my claim. I'm in trouble. And you said you were a very present help in the time of trouble. I'm in trouble, so come get me. And then there in that moment, he looks around and God seems absent. And what's distressing is him, I thought it worked this way, that you love me and when I was in need, I cry out to you and you help me. What's going on here? And what's hurting him in this moment is not even the problem, it's the sense of rejection. It's that feeling of being forsaken. Of I'm in crisis and so I'm gonna run to your arms for you to hold me. And then I watch the door slam and hear the bolt click. And it's that feeling of rejection that he's, man, well, what is this? I remember for me, my freshman year of college, if I could define it, it felt like the year of God's silence. That I had some questions I needed answered, some problems I had. And I was the good youth group kid in high school. So I'm like, okay, God, here's my problems. And I just felt like he didn't answer them forever. And you go, what's going on here? And it's starting to stress him out. The silence of God is deafening in his moment of suffering. I don't know if any of you have ever felt that. But what's interesting is the psalmist decides to press into that. He decides to enter into the struggle and figure it out. Okay, why is God forsaking me? Why am I crying out and he's not answering? Why is God forsaking me? Is it a God problem? Is it him? And then he looks in verse 3 and he says, no, because yet you are holy. You're pure. You're not duplicitous. You're not fake. You don't change. There's not some character flaw in God. So it's not that. And then he says, you're enthroned on the praises of Israel. What does that mean? Well, the idea back then was when they would pray, they'd pray towards the temple. Because towards the temple, there was the Holy of Holies. They had that Ark of the Covenant where it had a lid on the top called the mercy seat. It was like a picture of the throne of God. And as they would pray, they would swing incense. And the idea was, they said, the incense is like the prayers of the people. And incense would rise up around this altar. And it was this picture. And God gave them the picture. God said, in the same way that this incense rises up around this kind of picture, this Ark of the Covenant, it's the same way your prayers come to me. It was God telling his people, hey, I'm God, I'm holy, I don't change, and I hear you. I'm not deaf, I didn't miss you. I hear the prayers of my people. So he said, so okay, you're holy, you hear people. And not only do you hear people, when the fathers cried out to you, it worked for them. And you see it in verses 4 and 5, he repeats it 3 times. They trusted you, they trusted you, they trusted you. And as he goes on, he says, the fathers, believers of old, they trusted you, you delivered them. They cried to you, you rescued them. They trusted in you, and they weren't put to shame. And so he's telling himself, hey, look, man, even in the moment of this crisis, God is holy, God hears, God helps the fathers. He helped back then. He came through for those people. And he's trying to preach to himself to get hope. But then as he compares it to his experience, it starts to actually stress him out. He says, okay, God's holy. God listens. God cared for the fathers. And yet he's still not answering me. I'm groaning and you're far from saving. I'm crying and you're not answering. I cry and I find no rest. And it's that contradiction between my faith and what the Bible tells me and my experience that's stressing him out. So he says, there's some kind of breakdown here. And if it's not you, God, if you're holy, maybe it's me. Maybe I'm the problem, right? And so he gets to the next step and they go, okay, you know what? I'm a worm and I'm not a man. He says, maybe that's the problem. Is the problem is you're holy and you're good and you help other people, but apparently I'm not worth your time. I'm a nobody. And I see a lot of people that when they give up on Christianity, maybe they were raised in the church and they punt it later. A lot of them, it's here. I hit a moment of crisis where I really needed God to come through and he didn't. And so either he doesn't care or I'm not worth his time, so I'm out. And I remember sitting with a friend weeping as she walked away from the faith because she realized in the moment when I was abused as a girl, God was silent. And so, you know what? I'm done with him. Apparently, he doesn't think I'm worth his time. And some of you felt that. And yet the psalmist sitting here talking to you, okay, maybe it's me. I'm a nobody. And not only am I a nobody, I'm a joke. The silence of God is tough on him. It's hard. And then what makes it worse is that his peers aren't silent. That empty space gets filled with mockery. He says, I'm scorned by mankind, despised by the people. All who see me mock me. They make mouths at me. They wag their heads at me. The primary problem was the silence of God. The secondary problem is the cruelty of people. I think most of us know that, that people can be cruel, right? Psalm 22 declares it. See also the internet. That we sometimes like to kick people when they're down, and some of us have felt that. And here he's crying out for help, and all he gets is laughed at. And they said, he trusts in the Lord, let him deliver him. Let him rescue him, for he delights in him. They kind of mock his faith, right? And so I think what hurts, you go, why does he care what other people say? I think it's because it's got a little bit of truth to it. He says, yeah, I do belong to God, and God's not here with me. And so he starts to talk to himself again. I'm going, yeah, maybe I'm a nobody, and you just punted me from I'm a nobody, but they're saying you're somebody, and you know what? Yeah, I am a nobody, but I am your nobody. And so he flips around again. He's in crisis. I hope you feel that. Some of you who wrestle with God, that's what's happening here. He's wrestling and he flips back around and he says, yeah, I'm a nobody, but I'm your nobody. In verse 9, yet you are he who took me from the womb. You made me trust you at my mother's breast. On you I was cast from my birth, and from my mother's womb, you've been my God. He says, yeah, I'm a nobody, but I'm your nobody. You. You're the one who grabbed me. You're the one who came to get me. You're the one that I was a kid. You caused me to believe in you. You made me one of your people. That's how you work. And so as he's in the middle of his suffering and his crisis, he's trying to put the pieces together theologically, and he's looking and going, okay, God's holy. God doesn't change. God hears my prayers. He hears me crying. Okay, so I'm a nobody, so maybe God's just blowing me off. But no, I'm a nobody, but I'm his nobody. He grabbed me. He pulled me in. So why is he forsaking me? And he gets to a moment where he realizes there's nothing good in me. You're like, hey, God, I've been a straight-A student. He doesn't start pulling out all of why he's someone that God should pay attention to. But he's gotten to the point of wrestling where he says, God is holy. God hears his prayers. I belong to God. And so even though I don't understand why he's not listening to me, I don't know. I know that I'm a nobody, and I know that people are mocking me, and I'm not sure how to connect all this. All I know is that you are holy. You are good. You called me to you. And so in verse 11, he turns the corner and cries out, be not far from me, for trouble is near and there's none who can help. He cries out. And here's what's interesting about it. I don't know what kind of pain you're wrestling with this semester or what kind of pain you've experienced, but you know what's interesting about verse 11? Do you hear what he doesn't say? He doesn't say, so solve my problem. Deal with this thing. Give me this answer. Give me this relationship. Give me this job. He doesn't do that. What does he say? He makes it personal. Don't be far from me. Come be with me. It's relational. It's communal. Yeah, I want the problem solved, but I want the distance covered. I want you near me. Please be near me. And I hope you get some encouragement from that tonight, that in the midst of his suffering and his struggle, the psalmist does not move away from God. He moves towards God. Why? Because even in the midst of his struggle, he understands that it's a struggle with a God who he's allowed to talk to like this. that he's supposed to talk to like this. You don't talk to your banker like this. You don't enter into formal relationships like this. You don't look at a professor and go, just don't be far from me. Come be with me. No, no. He doesn't want that relationship with you. It'd be weird. But you talk to a spouse that way. You should. Someone you're in a covenant relationship with, that you're bound with, if you feel emotional distance and struggling, you should say things like that. I feel far from you. I want you near me. I want to be close. And I want you to hear that. The Bible is a very three-dimensional book. It's showing you how to struggle with God. It's a relationship. It's not a here's three happy steps to a happy life. It's a relationship, and there's dynamics and confusion. And whenever you communicate, you risk being misunderstood. And there's some misunderstanding in here. And so the psalmist says, hey, I don't understand what all is going on, but I want you close to me. And what you hear in this moment is you don't see a guy who's given up. If he'd given up, what? He would have stopped talking. See, in counseling circles, when they counsel married couples, when people come in yelling and screaming at each other, that's not the worst situation. That's actually a good situation. I mean, it's not good. But if you see a husband and wife yelling at each other, what's happening? They're yelling at each other. Why? Because they want the other person to understand them. They want the other person to get their point of view. They want to reach a point of misunderstanding, even though they might be doing it in the wrong way and unhealthy ways, not saying helpful things to each other. At least they're facing each other and trying to work on it. I want to be understood and I want to connect. The scary relationships, the one my counselor's friends say have almost no hope, is when there's disdain. And when one partner is cold, I don't care. I don't care what she says. I don't care. When communication stops is when the relationship is in deep trouble. And so here, the relationship is white hot. Hot, you can bend, right? Cold just shatters. And here, this relationship has the heat of struggle, of I am in this with you and I am struggling. So when Jesus cried out, why have you forsaken me? It's not a loss of hope. It's actually the presence of hope. He's saying, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far? Why are you? He's saying that, why? Because he's engaging God. It's not the cry of a lack of hope. It's a cry from hope of, I believe you're listening and I believe you care, so I'm going to dialogue with you until we get to a place of clarity, right? And here's the reality, and I love the way Golden Gay said it. He said, when the psalmist and when Jesus cried out this, why have you forsaken me? They weren't primarily looking for explanation, but for action. When Jesus cried out, why have you forsaken me? He wasn't necessarily looking for an explanation of why. It was a call to action. And you go, what do you mean by that? I do this with my kids. I do it with my daughters. I'll say to them sometime, why are you whining like that? And when I say that, I'm not looking for an explanation. Well, it's because I don't respect you and I'm tired and I go, oh, okay, well, I'm glad I know that. I just cognitively wanted to process that. Thanks, I'm going to stew on that, right? I'm saying to them, why are you whining? But I'm not looking for an explanation. I'm looking for them to change their behavior. I'm asking why, but what I really mean is stop, right? And here you see, if you didn't catch it implicitly in verse 1, it becomes explicit in verse 11. I'm asking, why are you forsaking me? Not because I want God to say, well, for these reasons. It's because I want you to stop forsaking me. I want you to be near me. Right? And so it's not the cry of a loss of hope. It's a cry from hope. Of, I believe there's a relationship here that's worth fighting for. So he fights for it. And I hope this is encouraging to you because you're meant to do this. The psalmist prays like this. Jesus prayed like this. And you pray like this. In the midst of your great suffering, don't move away from God. Move towards him. Beat on his chest if you have to. But engage in the relationship. He's calling you to talk to him like this, right? And so Jesus does this. Why? Because I think he's honestly communicating his honest anguish on the cross. I think that's why Jesus quoted Psalm 22. As he was quoting this anguish, God, I am in suffering and I want you near. And I get that. I don't understand it to the fullness, one idea what he went through.
But I think Jesus, as he hung there on the cross and he who knew no sin became sin for us, he knew that was coming. He told people about it. I think when he said, "Why have you forsaken me?" part of it for him is, "Why is this taking so long? Why are you so far?" A second of distance from his Father would have been brutal. For minutes to click by and hours, I think he screamed out in anguish. I remember for me when I had one of my back injuries where three discs were blown out and pain was radiating down my legs. I had to lay on my face on the floor for a month. You can look at old breakaway videos. I lost 40 pounds because I was laying on the floor in pain. Not great days. And yet I had a theology of God ordained suffering for his purposes, and I got that, and I was trying to tell myself that, trying to preach to myself, okay, God's got purpose in this, God's got reason for this. But as the minutes click by, the hours click by, the days click by, I remember at one point, every time the AC would click on, just that little shudder in the air would cause a wave of spasm down my back and my legs, and then I got the hiccups. And about an hour into hiccups, I just went, "Really? Why are you doing this?" And I wasn't looking for an explanation. I was asking, why is this taking so long? Why is this taking so long? And so I think Jesus is actually crying out in anguish, "I want this to be over." But I think there's another reason why Jesus picked this particular psalm when he was on the cross. There are other verses he could have quoted to put words to his pain. I think he picked this one because he was a good teacher. And I think in that moment, he wanted to show us something. And this is where it gets really, really crazy. Because I think for some of us, if you've been tracking verses 1 through 11, you kind of go, I can resonate with some of this. I can feel some of this. But in the next several verses, honestly, the experience of the person writing just sends to zoom past us in terms of the depth of suffering. I don't know if you felt that when you read it, but I did, with going, okay, I'm kind of with you, I'm kind of with you. Okay, no, what you went through sucks. Like, that is way worse. And not only is it way worse, it starts to get very, very specific. Strangely specific. And he breaks back into lament in verse 12, and then 12 through 18, he kind of goes through two cycles that roughly parallel, that basically talk about the strength of his enemies and the powerlessness of the righteous sufferer. And so he pictures these people tormenting him as animals. Why animals? Because they have power and no conscience. And so in verse 12, he says, "Bulls encompass me." They're like bulls. When you think of a bull, you think of power. And he says, "Strong bulls of Bashan surrounded me. There's no escape." And they're not just bulls. They're strong bulls from an area known for well-fed livestock. What he's saying is, my enemies have come around me. There's no escape. And they are at the peak of their strength. And they're not just like bulls. They're like lions. They're not just strong. They want to use that strength to tear me apart. And meanwhile, while they're at their strongest, I'm at my weakest. And he says in verse 14, "I am poured out like water. All my bones are out of joint. My heart is like wax. It's melted within my breast." As I was hiking with a friend last week, we hiked 18 miles in a day. And I remember at one point he looked up and he said, "My legs are jello." And what did he mean by that? He meant they've been walking so long, their strength is depleted. And so he said, they're like jello. Why say that? They've lost their structure. They've lost their ability to hold together. They're disintegrating. They're falling apart. They didn't have jello in 1000 BC. So he says, "I'm like water and I'm like wax." Water has no substance, has no structure. What I mean? Wax, when it melts, it loses structure. And here in the midst of his suffering, he says, "All my strength is gone. My body is breaking down. It's coming apart. My strength is dried up like a potsherd. I'm like a plant without water. I'm shriveling up." And then he does something so interesting in verse 15. "My strength is dried up. My tongue sticks to my jaws. You lay me in the dust of death." He does a pretty significant pronoun switch. These enemies are after me. But he's talking to God. And he says, "Behind all this, God, you're the one who put me here." Which sounds pretty horrible. God did that? God's the ultimate agent behind all this suffering? That sounds pretty horrible. Like, it sounds like betrayal. Like, God, you're a part of this? But certainly it can sound like betrayal, but I think it can also sound a little bit like hope. And you go, what do you mean by that? What I mean is my 2-year-old daughter went in and got shots today. Bad day. Hard day. When you're 2 years old, you don't understand a lot of the mechanics of what's going on. But you know that some grown-ups are going to hold you down and stick needles in you. Not good day. Question. When you're that little and you don't understand why these people are doing these things to you, which is worse? To have mommy there and have that instant of sense of betrayal of, why are you doing this? But then maybe behind that a sense of, but you're here and I know you love me. I got a couple years backing up proof that you love me, so maybe there's purpose in this? Or would you rather have her just be gone and you are in the hands of ruthless people that don't care about you? Which is worse? I would say this has a bit of hope. He says, I'm surrounded by enemies and I hate this, but you're behind him. I don't get it, but you're back there. I see you. He says, the dogs encompass me. They feast on death. A company of evildoers encircle me. And then he starts to get really strangely specific. They've pierced my hands and feet. That word pierced is the word in Hebrew, pierced, to bore a hole. They've borne a hole in my hands and feet. I can count all my bones. It means my body's stretched out and I can see my bones. They stare and gloat over me. They divide my garments among them. And from my clothing, they cast lots. They start distributing my things in front of me before I'm even dead. Now, some of you read this and you go, okay, piercing my hands and feet, gloating over me, dividing my garments, casting lots for my clothes. I've heard this before. This is what happened to Jesus on the cross. And yes, and let me just say, now is probably a good time to remind you that this was written 1,000 years before Jesus was on the scene. 1,000 years. Next year, America's birthday, America will turn 240 years old. That's 4 times the length of there's been in America. That's like Vikings describing the iPhone. Well, you swipe left if you want to delete something. That's weirdly specific. And let me tell you something, I hope that starts dawning on you why when Jesus was in the middle of his suffering, he selected this psalm to quote from the cross, because I think in the midst of that moment as a good teacher, he said, I want to cry out my pain, but let me do it in a place that as my disciples, the people who love me, are watching all their dreams get smashed, watching their hero get humiliated in front of everybody, while they experience that and try to live into that as you read the Gospels this next week, and I hope you will as a part of Holy Week, to see their hopes dashed in the middle of that moment, to hear him cry out this with the hopes that they'll remember this song they sang as kids. And let me tell you something, at some point they picked up on it. Because Matthew and Mark and Luke and John, as they begin to write the stories of the gospel, they begin to realize, no, I saw this. Matthew begins to talk about it and he says, and when they had crucified him, they divided his garments among them and cast lots. He looked around and said, no, they did that. He says, those who passed by derided him, wagging their heads. So also the chief priests with the scribes and elders mocked him, saying, he trusts in God. Let God deliver him now. And then in the 9th hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, saying, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani. My God, why have you forsaken me? And Jesus quotes this Psalm, why? So his disciples, in the midst of their suffering, when it all seemed like it had gone crazy, could hear a reminder from 1,000 years ago saying, but there is somebody behind this, that God is ruling over this, that God called this shot, and maybe there's some purpose to all this. Now, there's some comfort in hearing that, but I'm sure for them, they go, okay, there's a plan that was set in motion long ago for this, but I still don't understand the plan. To what end are you doing this? Why is this happening? Well, as the psalm shifts, you see in verses 19 and 20 and 21, this cry out again for help. Do not be far off. Come quickly to my aid. Deliver my soul. And then verse 21, save me from the mouth of the lion. So he's crying out, don't be far. Come quickly. Deliver me. Save me. And then he's not even out of the verse. And he says, you have rescued me from the horns of the wild oxen. Say what? When did that happen? No, wait a second. Don't be far off. Help me. Come quickly. Deliver me. Save me. Saved. Done. When? When did that happen? Like, no, seriously. What on earth? And he uses the perfect tense of the verb. It's done. He's crying out, deliver me, help me, save me. Oh, good, I'm out. What? And it's interesting to read commentators and them read that and go, yeah, what happened in the middle of verse 21? It's not even a next verse. In the middle of the verse, what happened? And they're like, I don't know. But somehow, he goes from surrounded by bulls and lions and dogs to surrounded by the brothers who are praising a God who saves. And you see in verse 22, the next verse, he says, I'll tell of your name to my brothers. In the midst of the congregation, I'll praise you. Now he's surrounded by friends and they're singing. You who fear the Lord, praise him. All the offspring of Jacob, glorify him. Stand in awe of him, the offspring of Israel. He says, all my people, my Jewish people, celebrate God. Why? Because he has not despised or abhorred the afflictions of the afflicted. He's not hidden his face from him. He's heard him when he cried for him. He says, he didn't reject me. It looked like he did, but he didn't. And not only did he not reject me, in verse 25, he says, from you comes my praise in the great congregation. A great congregation of people are going to celebrate you. My vows I will perform before those who fear him, because the afflicted shall eat and be satisfied. Those who seek him shall praise the Lord. He says, I was afflicted. I thought he wasn't hearing me, but he heard me. And he delivered me. And not only me, but everyone who's afflicted will be at a banquet, will be at a party, praising the God who gives life. Jesus said as much. Do you remember at the Last Supper, on the night he was betrayed? He had a meal with his disciples and he broke bread and gave it to them. And he said, hey, this is my body that's going to break. And then he held up a glass of wine and passed it around to them. And as they took it up, he said, hey, this is my blood that's about to be poured out. He said, I'm going to be rejected and I'm going to be murdered. I'm going to be killed. He says, but then when I rise again, we're going to celebrate in the new kingdom and have a meal together. And the disciples were like, what? Okay. Didn't understand it. And yet here in this moment, you have suddenly in this place, this psalm from 1,000 years ago declaring it's going to get real bad. And then suddenly, bad's over. And in that moment, there's going to be a party. And the brothers are going to come. And we're going to celebrate together. Because God heard me when I was afflicted. And from him will come praise. And praise not just from me, but all the afflicted who come to my table will eat and be satisfied. And then he just says, not all the Jewish people. In verse 27, he says, all the ends of the earth shall remember and turn to the Lord. All the families of the nations will worship before you. Kingship belongs to the Lord. He rules over the nations. All the prosperous of the earth will eat and worship. He says, all the rich people are going to come and worship God. Before him shall bow down all who go to the dust, even those who could not keep themselves alone. All poor people are going to come to him. So all kinds of socioeconomic backgrounds are going to come. And then not only all these people from all nations and all families from all different backgrounds, he says, posterity shall serve him. It shall be told to the Lord to a coming generation. They shall come and proclaim his righteousness to a people yet unborn that this will happen. He says, not just my people, but every family on the planet of people throughout time. People are going to come celebrate God, not in spite of what happened to this poor guy, but because of it, that the incredible suffering of the righteous one will result in joy and celebration and praise for people of all nations, all families, all walks of life, all statuses, for all time. And as you hear that, you go, this psalm suddenly just got a lot bigger than David. That what I went through, this suffering and my vindication and redemption will be a cause of celebrating for people from every nation and every family, even yet unborn for all time. That's bigger than David because it's about the Son of David. It's about the Son of God. It's about Jesus Christ, who suffered and died at the hands of sinful men according to the expressed will of God, so that by his blood he could purchase men and women from every tribe and tongue and nation. So we could remember, even in our darkest days, kingship belongs to the Lord. He rules the nations. Your pain is not outside his plan. His plans are good for his children. He who ordained to take the darkest day in history, the crucifixion of Jesus, and make it the instrument of our redemption, will take even your darkest days and redeem them for his glorious purposes. That's true. So we can say along with the psalmist, he hasn't despised or abhorred the afflicted. He's not hidden his face from me. He heard me. And so let me close here. Let's just make sure I've answered our questions with some degree of finality. Why did Jesus cry out, my God, why have you forsaken me? I think he was expressing the anguish of being separated from God, that he who knew no sin became sin for us. I think it was a true cry of pain. And I also think he did it as a teacher to point us to the fact that his suffering was designed by God for greater purposes, our redemption, to call out a congregation who would worship him for all days. What does it mean for us? It means we can and we should cry out to God when we're suffering. Whatever you're going through, family distress, financial distress, internal emotional turmoil, cry out to him because you know he wants to hear it. And cry out to him as people who know that if God took the darkest day in history, Jesus' death, and used it as the means of purchasing the redemption and joy and celebration of people from all nations, that he will take your dark days and redeem them for his purposes. You can have that kind of hope. It's interesting, the writer of Hebrews quotes Psalm 22 as well. And he says that Jesus is not ashamed to call us brothers, saying, I will tell of your name to my brothers. In the midst of the congregation, I'll sing your praise. What's interesting is he quotes Psalm 22 in that moment, but after the redemption moment. And so it leads you to this natural question, when did Jesus say that? And he doesn't tell us. You go, is it when he inspired the psalm 1,000 years before he was born? Maybe. Some people think on the cross, Jesus quoted all of Psalm 22. I don't know. No idea. But I know that he said it, that Jesus said, I am going low, so God will raise me high. And as I come high, I'm going to redeem some brothers. I'll be a part of a family that will come around me, and my suffering will be an instrument of their redemption. And so the Hebrew writer of Hebrews says, why did he do this? In verse 14, since therefore the children share in flesh and blood, he himself likewise partook of the same, that through death he would destroy the one who had power over death, that is the devil, and deliver all those who through fear of death were subject to slavery all their lives. Therefore he has been made to be like his brothers in every respect, so that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest in the service of God, to make propitiation for the sins of the people. For because he himself has suffered when tempted, he's able to help those who are being tempted. He presents two pictures of Jesus. One is as a champion who fights on our behalf. He fought as our representative, and so what he won, his plunder, is given to us. And he says, Jesus went to death and tasted it, so you don't have to. He beat death so you can have hope in life. And then he also presents him as a high priest that's sympathetic. Jesus went through enormous suffering to buy your redemption. And so when you go through enormous suffering, you don't have to look up and go, God, you don't know what this is like. I think he does. I think he does. And you can know, no, he knows exactly what this is like. He knows what rejection from your close friends looks like. He knows what mockery and bullying looks like. He knows what physical pain looks like. He's tasted it. He knows it. And he also knows that the God who ordained that his suffering be redeemed it because he works all things for the good of those who love him and are called according to his purposes. So when you're in the midst of suffering, you can go, Jesus, I know you know this suffering and I know you know there's purpose in it. So I'm yours and I trust you. And the last thing is, what do we do with this? I love the place the psalm ends because it ends with saying that from you comes my praise in the great congregation. My vows I'll perform before those who fear him. The afflicted shall eat and be satisfied. Those who seek him shall praise the Lord. They shall come and proclaim his righteousness to people yet unborn, that he's done it. He says, as we see the affliction of Jesus and his redemption, when we experience our own affliction, we can trust that God will even use that. And what happens when we live that story with Jesus? We become mouthpieces of redemption to people around us. That as a congregation, we celebrate a God who would do this, that takes even our darkest moments and makes them glorious. We celebrate that. For me, my freshman year in college was one of the darkest of my life. So difficult. The silence of God was excruciating for me. And yet I remember as I began to write out in my journals just all these questions I had that God would not answer me. Finally, there came a day where, I think I've told this story before, I was walking through the mall and I walked past a Christian bookstore and there was a Bible sitting on a podium and a light was shining down on it. And it was a funny looking setup. It was like, oh, you know, I was kind of like, I must turn and see this strange thing, right? And that morning I had written in my journal a question I had while reading the Bible, and I wrote under it, there's no answer. And truly that morning I thought, this is the end of my belief about any of this. And I walked past that book, and I remember I turned and looked at it, and it was a Bible that had big wide margins with questions in them in bold and the answers underneath them. And after months, the majority of my freshman year struggling with all kinds of issues, I remember walking by and seeing it open to the passage I just read, my question in bold in the top left corner, and the answer underneath it. And so I read it and went, huh. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And there was no angelic singing. It was me in a bookstore. And it was just a little whisper from God of going, trust me. Trust me. Cling to me. Don't run from me in your pain. Run towards me. And it was just a little hint of a whisper of his voice. I'm taking you through this pain for a purpose. And I don't have time to go through all of it with you, but he was taking me through pain for a purpose. And by the end of it, God had done some healing in my life, some mending of some things in me that I always thought would be broken. And I remember by the end of my freshman year, I could confidently say to other human beings what I always felt uncomfortable saying, even as a church kid, I love him. I love him because he came for me. And he got me, and I'm his, and he's my God, and he has not abhorred the affliction of the afflicted. And so I will praise him in the congregation, and I will celebrate him before all the peoples. I'll proclaim his name even to those who aren't born yet, because he has done it. He rescued and redeemed through Jesus, and he will rescue and redeem all who call upon his name.
Well, howdy, and welcome to the Breakaway Podcast. My name is Hannah, and I'm sitting here with Ben Stewart on a Tuesday night after Breakaway. And we just got back from spring break. All students are back, and we had a great night. We shared the Shalom results, which were incredible. Our students and other people involved with Shalom raised $267,625.25.
Yeah. Which is insane.
Amazing.
267,000. I think the most we've ever raised with Shalom was like 140, I believe.
Right.
And it's just mind-blowing to me. I really feel like students, and not just students, but you guys, I mean, different people gave, like came around this, the importance of this, that there are Christian brothers and sisters being persecuted in the world, and we can do more than sit back and go, oh man, somebody should do something, that when one part of the body suffers, all suffer, and we are meant to come alongside them. So I'm just so blown away by this, so encouraged by it. The students were, they went bananas hearing that number, and I just love that through Voice of the Martyrs and Elam, we're going to get to do far more than we had anticipated or planned. And I'm just asking God would do amazing things with it, that little kids now would grow up to adults and say, I'm here, and I was fed, and I was cared for, and I was nurtured, and I was given a surgery because some people that love Jesus in Texas decided to care about me. And I'm just asking for God to do immeasurably more with that than we could even know how to ask or imagine. Yeah. So encouraged by it.
Yeah, it was an amazing night. It was fun to share those results and excited that that money's going to help our brothers and sisters in need. So, it was a great night. We were back in the Psalms tonight. So Ben, did you have additional things you wanted to say?
I do, Hannah. I've got, you know what? I'm just going to say two. Sure. There's obviously more you could do. There's a lot going on with this Psalm, which is unbelievable. And if you're wondering, I'll say this. So there's three things. One is if you're like, I would love to study the Psalms more deeply. How do I do that? I will say that the Word Biblical Commentary series, WBC, there's a guy, I believe he pronounces it Craigie, that his commentary on the Psalms has been wonderful. So helpful. Derek Kidner has one as well too, with Tyndale. That was super helpful. And then of course, Spurgeon has his, treasury from the Psalms that were so good too. So many great resources, but I would aim you at those if you're, want to read a bunch of commentaries about the Psalms, go for it. But I would say two things that I thought were kind of cool we didn't have time to get to. One is this Psalm, you know, people tend to categorize Psalms, and I think there are three broad categories that we mentioned at the beginning of the series that Second Chronicles mentions, you know, the lament of life is really hard. There's the lament Psalms. You know, there's praise Psalms of celebrating God. You know, there's petition, asking him for things. This is a lament psalm, deep suffering, and there's kind of a typical script they follow, sort of like our songs, like pop songs kind of follow a script, different psalms kind of follow a script. And normally for David, with these kind of psalms, it's here's my complaint, here's what's going wrong, God help me. And then there's frequently a call for and judge the people that are hurting me. Deal harshly with them. Rebuke them. You know, sort of David comes after him a little bit, you know, stop these people. And what's interesting about this psalm is there's none of that. It jumps out because of that. It's a lament, but he doesn't say, God punish the wicked, God destroy my enemies. He doesn't say that in this psalm. And what's beautiful about that is, you know, this is obviously, I mean, one commentator called this the fifth gospel. I mean, it is a presentation of the crucifixion and resurrection of Jesus. It's right. Unbelievable. And there's no call for retribution or destruction at all. It fits perfectly with what Jesus said on the cross as they mocked him and rebuked him. He said, Father, forgive them because they don't know what they're doing. And so Jesus doesn't call for judgment in that moment. He calls for grace. And I thought that was pretty powerful that the psalm Jesus quotes is trying to call our attention to is one that doesn't ask God to judge, though God has the right to do so and will. It asks for grace, which is pretty amazing. And the other one's just a little technical thing. People ask all the time, like in the Gospels, why when Jesus said this, it says, and Jesus cried out, and different people pronounce it different ways, but Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, which means, my God, why have you forsaken me? It's kind of weird to think about, why does he say it that way? The New Testament wasn't written in English. It was written in Greek. So we translate all the rest into English, and Jesus said all that. But why do we have this one section that's not written in English? And he said this, which means this. Like, why does it say that? And it's because that's a translation from Matthew and Mark. That's how they say it. And you go, well, why were they saying something in a language and then having to translate it? What's going on? Well, because when Jesus kicked around, he spoke Aramaic. as did most Jewish people, is the language they picked up in the dispersion. That's what they spoke as they kind of kicked around with other Jewish people. They spoke Aramaic. The Gospels weren't written in Aramaic. They were written in Greek. And so to a Greek speaker, listening to Jesus yell it, they wouldn't have known what he was saying. Mm-hmm. They didn't speak Aramaic. It was a Jewish language in a sense. And so that's why when these writers say that, they said, and he said, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, which means, and then they're translating into Greek, my God, why have you forsaken me? He does it other places. And he said to the little girl, Talitha kumi, which means little girl, get up. Like, why are they doing that? Right? Because he said these really powerful statements, but he said it in a language they didn't understand. And so the writers translate what Jesus said. And you go, why is that significant? Well, I think it's kind of cool because one thing it hints at and shows you is that the Gospels were written in Greek, which was the trade language of the day, you know? So you might have grown up in a different place that spoke different languages, but everybody spoke Greek. Hmm. It was, if you had to get any commerce done, you spoke Greek. And there was the kind of high level, what we call classical Greek, and then there was the koine, which means common or street. And the Gospels were all written in street level Greek because it's a message for everybody. It was put in the language that would make it absolutely accessible to everybody. And so as the gospel writers wrote, they knew Aramaic, but they didn't write the gospel in Aramaic. They wrote it in Greek because they said that's the language of the world and the whole world needs to know this message. So if you're just wondering why it's written like that, that's why. But I think it's a cool little message for us is the gospel was written in the language that would get the gospel out. And so that's what we live to do. It's a message worth sharing, right?
Yeah.
So anyway, it was fun to teach this. Kind of hard to preach Psalms, but it was really fun. And stick around with us because we got a couple more weeks left.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we will be back in Reed Arena next Tuesday at 9 p.m. So we'll see you guys there.